Circle of Health, and this is the ninth episode of the Development Hell podcast. Ed, we've made it to number nine. We haven't gotten any panicked emails or phone calls from our awesome sponsor, Engine Yard. So either they haven't listened to the podcast or they're cool with what we had to say.
I'm pretty sure they haven't listened to it.
So this week, as usual, we have Chris Hartjes on the one side, and on the other side of the crappy Skype connection that I have up in Kanuckistan is Ed Finkler. Say hello to the internet, Ed.
Hello, internet.
And this week we have a special guest. It is Nathan Fritz. Say hi to everybody, Nathan.
Aloha.
Nice.
So Nathan is coming to us from the sunny Pacific Northwest. Whereabouts exactly are you again, Nathan?
Kennewick, Washington. So BFE.
Have you ever seen a Sasquatch up there?
I'm not sure. Sometimes I wonder if it was a dream or if it really happened.
Oh, okay. I think if Nathan would let his hair grow, he'd look like Sasquatch.
Oh, yeah, maybe.
Yeah, kind of a hairy guy.
I was really into, Bigfoot when I was a kid. Like, I used to read a lot of books about it, stuff like that. So that was always when that shit was going down, was in the Pacific Northwest.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and up in Canada, too.
Well, that's part of the Pacific Northwest.
Oh, yeah, you went there already, huh, Ed?
I didn't say Pacific Northwest United States. But we can say it's that way, too, if you want. We'll annex you. In Fallout lore, the United States annexes Canada in 2060-something.
Yeah, it's getting there.
Yeah, we're getting there.
Yeah.
Both of you guys are dicks.
We annex you for your wood.
And there's no wood quite like Canadian.
No, there's
That's
not.
Right. It's the friendliest wood you can find.
There you go. Oh. Right.
All right, time to get this show on the road, Ed. So,
all right.
Nathan, why don't you tell all three of our listeners a little bit about yourself, and then I'll explain why I coerced you into coming onto the podcast.
Okay, so I'm chief architect at Andiette. I've had more jobs than I can count on fingers and toes, but I've been here at Andiette for working on my third year now. So what I do is I help pick the tools and design the tools and design the software that we produce for clients and produce for our own products. So that's basically what I do. I'm a language agnostic. I don't believe in any supreme language, but maybe one exists.
Well, it's going to be a short podcast then.
Yeah. So, yeah, we can argue about that later, I guess. So I'm the father of two. Been married for 11 years. Let's see, what else is there?
Well, that's good for a start.
Yeah, seems
I like driving slow cars really fast.
Like a, what, like a steamroller?
Not that slow.
Oh, okay, right.
So the main reason why I asked Nathan to join us on the show is that Nathan is one of my adoring fans on Twitter. And when he saw me talking about...
Wait, so you brought him on here just so he'd, kiss your ass?
Fuck yeah.
Okay. I mean, that's why I'm here.
Yeah, right.
And so Nathan has been acting as a very generous unpaid consultant for my travels through the Node world. So, and much like Ed, he knows a lot about JavaScript. So I thought it would be interesting to have Nathan on because he deals with an area of application architecture that I haven't had too much experience with yet, but it seems inevitable that as WebPy picks up more steam, that's Nathan doesn't know this, but that's my pet name for Web 3, 3.14159, because it just keeps fucking going on forever, that we're moving towards the real-time web. Everything is pointing towards people's expectations of web applications to be responsive in real time. And there's a collection of tools and techniques and architectures that lend themselves really well towards building real-time apps. So we're eventually going to get to that, but I'm going to start off. We have our usual little pirate pad up. And so some of the notes I have here is that, so as Nathan mentioned, he is the chief architect for And Yet. And I believe, is there only two episodes in existence of your little Keeping It Real time?
Yeah. We keep talking. It's like from 2 years ago, too. We keep talking about bringing it back.
Yeah.
And we're just got to set up a schedule. And I think we're going to do audio only.
That's a good idea.
Because there's just way too much editing when it comes to video. We were doing, because, you know, you record an episode and then you do 2 days of editing, and that's just not worth it.
Yeah, because we do no editing on this podcast, so that works out really well.
Not really. Right. I got all screwed up last time. I had to do kind of a lot of editing last week.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, that's right, because in the middle of talking, the hotel Wi-Fi dropped my lease and said, you got to connect again, bro.
Yeah, and the right before that, the recording just started, like, missing segments, like, 10-second segments of stuff, so I had to, like, chop out some stuff that actually was sort of interesting, which kind of bummed me out, but...
Don't you hate it when, like, you're listening to a podcast, and they're like, hey, so we've been recording for the last half hour and lost all of that, so now we're starting over, and they all sound like they're trying to rehash what they did.
Yeah, they don't. You don't want to say it again. No, that's my biggest fear with this stuff, because we only are recording it, like, on my laptop, right? So... If I just accidentally hit the wrong button, first, it'll just screw everything up. And then secondly, there's going to be a time where we record a podcast and it happens to everybody where it'll just not, like it does, my cat walks on the computer and it deletes the file, or I just forget to hit record or some shit like that. So hopefully it won't happen with you, and you have to do this hellhole again. But, yeah, that always happens. So, I don't know. I forgot what we were talking about.
So. All right. So anyway, I was just going to talk some more about Nathan here. So yeah, so he's the chief architect astronaut for And Yet. What? But it's the other stuff that Nathan does that is interesting. So big time booster and contributor of code for XMPP, which I believe most people would know as the technology behind Jabber. Is that fair to say, Nathan?
Yes. Yeah. I mean, they're interchangeable.
And doesn't GTalk use that?
Yep.
Okay.
And so we have in our notes here in that you said this could also help form a discussion about why people hate XML so much. Because like I said, I used to work for a company called XML Team. So I've got lots of love for XML and understand its use and can appreciate when I look at it that I can... I can usually pretty quickly figure out what's going on. And so this also, and you made some notes here too, that why people hate SQL and why people should lighten up. So why don't we talk a bit about your thoughts on that whole scene?
Well, I mean, when people talk about XMPP, the first complaint is usually, well, it's XML. And then they get into specifics, like it's too verbose, it's hard to read, or all of those things. And all those things can be individually discounted, you know. It gzips about the same as JSON does, so why complain there? We get some more functionality, you know, that the extensible part of XMPP is because it's XML and you get namespace goodies and stuff like that. So you can argue all day long, but what it really comes down to and what they're not finding words for, at least I theorize, is that... they have no natural code representation of XML. So when you're working with XML, you've either got like something crappy like DOM, or you've got all these like steps you have to go through to even get to, you know, the data element that you're talking about, right? Or generating it to insert it. There's no native representation, and that's why everybody loves JSON, is because it's just like writing Python, JavaScript, whatever, right? It's just shorthand data structures.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. I mean, I guess I'm a fair advocate of JSON, you know, over XML for many things for that exact reason, is because I feel like it's easier to deal with because it maps much more cleanly to a programming data structure.
Right. And I would argue that's the same reason why we see this NoSQL movement.
Mm-hmm.
It's because, you know, SQL and tables and relationships and all those things don't map very well, aren't represented very well in code. So it's this stretch for developers that maybe only have, you know, a tenuous grasp on what XML is or what SQL is. Or
programming in general.
Right. So they're just like, well, why can't I just, right?
Right.
And so there's this, you know, there's this wave of, and some of it's not unfounded. I mean, if it's a pain in the butt, it should be easier, right? And some of that's the tools we use. And that's why we see the rise of ORMs. And with ORMs, it alleviates the problem somewhat for SQL.
Right.
And then you see better XML representations, better XML objects in code, and that alleviates the problem somewhat.
But I don't think I've ever seen an XML ORM. That would be a kind of interesting thing to see.
Sure. I mean, for Sleek XMPP, which is my Python library for XMPP, we were inspired by Blather, which is a Ruby XMPP library. And they use stanza objects. And basically, with attribute accessors, you're generating and destroying XML. And then you map these things together, and so you can really easily traverse and edit and find things in the XML with native object structures.
And I have to agree with you, too. I think that the ability to natively manipulate these things is a really big advantage.
Right. I mean, and that's where a lot of the hate from JavaScript comes from, is the DOM, right? Because the DOM is just a crappy way to deal with SGML, right?
Yes.
It's painful.
Yes, it is. I was thinking about that while we were discussing this, and I was like, one of the things is, I think because I started working with HTML first before I really got into what I call real programming, although I think a lot of people would argue with me that PHP is real programming, but that was a little joke.
I'm laughing on the inside.
I worked with HTML first, so I'm more comfortable like building HTML as HTML. But I think you run into a lot of programmers that want to build it programmatically, you know, and it makes sense. That's kind of what they're used to, and they don't want to screw around with, you know, a markup language. But I think so. I mean, that kind of makes sense. It's a hassle to translate it into a thing that into patterns that you're not used to, right? And to go back and forth between those.
Right. They just want to stay in code, right? And
right.
A lot of it is that you have so many developers that only know one programming language. Mm-hmm. And they just want to stay there. They don't want to go anywhere. And they don't want to have to grok something outside of their programming language.
Ooh, breaking up the nerd word.
Right. Well, yeah, I mean, if you can, quote, know XML and know SQL, right? But if you don't grok it, if you don't know it completely, if it's not second nature to you, you're not going to understand why the hell you're going to all the bother, right?
Yeah. Yeah, no, I dig you there.
So, Nathan, what do you think some kind of non-intuitive uses of XMPP are for people to kind of give them a better understanding of what kind of problems it can solve, and if there are some kind of non-obvious problems that something like XMPP can help with?
Well, I mean, really, it's just bidirectional streaming of data objects, right? So it's useful for of synchronizing of any kind. Like I helped a company do municipal Wi-Fi with it. Basically, they have all these routers all over the city, and they want to change a config or add somebody or whatever. And they also want to know if their router's up, right, or who's on and whatever. And XMPP provides presence and rosters and things like that as well. So not only can you sync the config, but you can see whether something is up right now or not, or what the status of things are. And let's see, I've done anytime you're just screaming data out and you don't want pullers, right? You want to push data out. People can just listen to these XMPP messages, and there's an XMPP library in practically every language. So it's really easy to just, you know, make a little wrapper on an XMPP lib for your API to listen to incoming events, rather than polling. There's a lot of other examples. I could go on for a while if you like.
Yeah, well, this ain't the XMPP podcast, so we have
to... All right.
So how does that... Do you have to... I'm pretty ignorant of XMPP. Like, I sort of know that it exists, and I knew it was based on XML, but do you have... You have a... Like, a two servers, and they just, like, open up a port and send shit at each other, basically? Or how does that work?
Well, yeah, and they can, and you can... So you can either be a server identity, or you can be a user identity at a server.
Mm-hmm.
And the server identity portion is verified through certificates and other security mechanisms, so that you have trust on the identity that you're sending to and receiving from.
Right.
So that you can actually authorize based on that identity rather than... have to re-authenticate every identity that you talk to.
I gotcha. Interesting.
That sounds like some really cool shit, Nathan.
It's fun. Yeah, I've been involved in various ways for a decade now, so it's good times.
The old man of XMPP.
But I've shifted my views over the years. I used to think that XMPP should be in everything, and I've recently sort of shifted away from that, where it's just too much overhead for the inside of your application to have to talk XMPP. Like, for example, an internal job system. The idea is sound. You have workers, and you'd like to know their presence, and you'd like to just hand them work, and we can certainly do that over XMPP. But it's more overhead than you need internally. To be generating, parsing XML, to be going through this XMPP server from these workers that you have now, have this extra component involved, and complicated component. The idea is that in XMPP is that clients are simple and servers do all the hard work. So internally, I've shifted my views away from that and have been, exploring AMQP and lighter messaging setups for internal process communication.
Cool. So the next thing I have on the list of something that you've been working on, and we're going to talk about the real-time web stuff later, is that you are writing, you're in the process of writing a Redis scripting book. Now, my experiences with Redis have been all positive. I look at Redis as a really awesome key value store that deals mostly with memory, in-memory stuff, but has some eventual consistency in the form of writing it out to disk. And it has some really cool add-on features. I forget what his actual real name is, but I know him as Anti-Rez on Twitter.
Yeah, Salvador.
Salvador. I'm sorry. I keep forgetting his name. And so I do know that Redis does support some scripting. So why don't you talk a bit more about what drew you to the scripting part of Redis? And I believe you're using mostly Lua? Is that what you're using?
Yeah, well, that's what the scripting is. So Redis is great because it's very simple. You could spend an afternoon and read through the code. You've got simple key values that are binary safe, and then you also have some objects like hashes and sets, scoring-based sorting sets, lists, linked lists. So you have these data structures that you're used to dealing with in your language of choice anyway, the database might as well deal with those as well. So what I've been working on a year ago, I started working on this thing called Thunk, which was this idea that I see real-time websites as a series of feeds. If you're looking at, to give a lame example, Facebook, you've got a feed of users that are online. You've got feeds of news. You've got feeds of various, your own settings even is a feed, right? If they change, your reference changes. So, if you could organize the data for an application into feeds, the theory was that, you could have really a data-driven website. So I started working on that, and it works really well for data-driven websites where you just break everything out into feeds, and then you essentially your server turns into just a feed manager, subscription manager for each session. And that works well, but it was difficult to work with, especially in Node, because Node's asynchronous, and you're doing all of these. You have to do multiple key calls, typically in a key store, to get anything done that's relational. And to make that atomic, Redis does sort of a passive atomic, where you say, I would like this to be atomic. Here's a value. If it changes, then these actions that I'm about to do, I want you to invalidate. So it's this passive thing where you try to be atomic, and then if it fails, it rewinds, and then you do it again. So you just have to. And it was complicated to work with. What Lua scripting brings is I can do all of these multi-key things on the server. I don't have to worry about any sort of asynchronous nature of what I'm doing. Everything's atomic. Everything's simple, dry. Where I might have really complicated logic where I'm messing with all sorts of data sets on the server to do one thing, like, say, post a forum post. I may be editing objects related to that thread. I may be changing objects related to my user, and you want all those things to be atomic. So what scripting does is I can write my whole function as a script. And so what Thunk has turned into is a script manager with the perspective of there being these higher level objects that we've created. There's almost a class. Each script becomes a method in the class, and certain keys become the instance of that class. So it really shifts things so that when I actually make a change, I do an action to the database. I've actually created my own object type on the database. I've made a database specifically for my application at this point because I have all of my own methods. I have every instance of that thing has its own keys, and I can really treat it as a high-level object.
That sounds hard.
It actually ends up being really simple, and because you just write it like you were writing, a class structure.
Right.
So you've got you just have to name your stuff right. So Thunk is basically a way to help you do that, and also it handles subscriptions. So Redis has publish subscribe in it. So what you can do is when you change an object, this will say I create this forum post, that can send out to a PubSub channel for that topic. It can also send out a forum topic for my user. So people can listen to these different channels, or rather endpoints can listen to these different channels and give live updates on what's going on if they're interested.
Yeah, Lua, I mean, from what I've seen in Lua, it's really nice. I have a friend of mine who really swears by it and loves using it for all sorts of stuff. So it's interesting that you've been able to kind of find something that bolts onto Redis that maps a lot better to the problem you're trying to solve with Thunk.
Right. Yeah, it was a lot less work. I was able to throw away most of the code. Now Thunk is a simple script manager, essentially.
So what tools have you been using to write the book?
So I tried a bunch of things for the book. And, you know, even I even played with what's the new iBook author that came out, you know. But I've been playing with all sorts of stuff, and I've never really been – the higher level tools, I've never been happy with how they support problems we have in the technical world with syntax highlighted code. And for the lower level tools, it felt like I was wasting my time learning lower level tools. So what I've moved to is Markdown And I use Vim for everything. So just Markdown in Vim, and I found a little preprocessor that allows me to include other files. So I run my preprocessor. It gathers all of my files based on includes.
You see that, Ed? Together. Other smart people are using Vim too. See? I keep telling you.
I'm just an idiot.
It's how old are you, Ed?
How old am I now? 36.
Oh, well, you're old enough for Vim.
Yeah, it's just I never used it.
And you've got a beard.
Right. So. I didn't get into being any way decent at programming until later, until after college. Yeah, 35. Well, I still argue I'm not decent at it, but, so in college I did, let's see, we did stuff in Turbo Pascal, which has its own, you know, it's basically an IDE, but that was all DOS, but it was, it has IDE, like the editors built into it and stuff. And then, then other stuff I did was all, it was GUI based. So there was one class that was Visual Basic, and then other, we did some stuff with, I guess with Unix. I don't know. What did I edit my shit in? I don't even know.
Nano.
Well,
or Pico.
I think it was Pico then. I think I was using Pico for stuff. But I was terrible. I was terrible at my CS classes in college. So by the time I actually got kind of serious about it, I was really coming out of doing HTML authoring. And so I was, you know, I think probably the first, like, halfway decent text editor I used was probably HomeSite 3.2.
Wow, there's a blast from the past.
Yeah, that was a great app, man. I find anything better for a long time.
So we're going to cut Ed short while you're
reminiscing
about his weak-ass editors. So, so are you self-publishing? Do you have a deal with somebody? Like, what's going on with that?
I'm not really concerned with it at this point. I think what's going to happen is Andiette's going to publish it. They're going to go into that. Maybe we'll use what you used LeanPub, right? Maybe we'll
I use LeanPub for my
try book, that. But at this point, it's kind of turned into a work project.
All right.
I'm pretty invested here, so it might as well be. And so we may just publish it ourselves. We certainly, you know, can do a shopping cart and. I'm not really concerned with rendering it. I've rendered it into a million formats. So, yeah, I don't know.
I was just curious because, and I've gone on at length about my experiences working with the LeanPub folks, and I found that just this automated system that they had set up, where just I could crank out the Markdown and then just go to a web page and. Through the miracle of Dropbox, just say, create a book for me, please. And they would do it all for me. So I was just kind of curious. I mean, self-publishing, like doing everything yourself, that's definitely a route to go down. Because, I mean, really, it's not that hard to set up a shopping cart. And it probably takes a couple of nights of hacking around to get a tool chain in place that will take your source files and crank out something that looks pretty good. So, so what's your time frame for it? You just kind of, it's going to get done when it's get done. Do you have a particular target in mind?
Well, I want it to get done before, the next Keeping It Real Time conference for sure. And you know, I originally wanted it to get done before, release candidate one of Redis 2.6, which is where they're, adding Lua scripting. So it's not a stable feature yet. And Antares today just posted that if he doesn't get any new bug reports in the next couple of days, that he's going to post RC1. So in some ways, I'm really close. Maybe I'm at the I did the first 90%. Maybe I've just got the last 90% to do.
Yeah, I saw your tweet there where you talked about how Antires grabbed a pull request of yours to tweak something to do with the Lua script.
Right. I added SHA checksums to scripting because what I wanted to do was to SHA passwords and then compare passwords right on the Redis side. So we've got this product called Anbang.com, and it's a team collaboration tool. And So you can see what everybody's up to. It's not really a task manager. It has task management, but mostly it's a tool to show at a higher level what everyone's up to. And it has a chat, and the chat can be XMPP and back end or IRC and back end. It's a cool tool. But anyway, so what I wanted to do, we're working on a rewrite of it right now.
It was just barely happening. You're rewriting it already.
Oh yeah. Yeah. It's just refactor all the time. Right. So we're rewriting the back end with stuff that I've learned in doing the book and the scripting stuff, because that's really cool. What we can do with this Lua scripting stuff is, since everything we've just made this custom database that's specific for our application, and it has live updates where things bubble up live. What we can do is the middle layer, the node layer, whatever's doing your web serving and your WebSocket serving, or your socket IO serving, or your long polling, or whatever APIs you have, is just a router at that point. The code is really simple for it. It just has a little wrapper, a Thunk wrapper in the native language that you're using, and you run the scripts as if it were, you just use it as if it were a native object, and then events bubble up all the way to the client side. Well, man, I've lost where I've gone. What was I talking about?
Welcome to the podcast. Yeah, this happens all the time. All right, yeah, you're telling how awesome your little bang thing is that you're rewriting constantly because you're all hipsters out on the West Coast. Okay, let's move on to the next topic.
You know, and we're learning things as we go. But anyway, what we can do is we can have, you know, say there's a library we like in Python, or a library we like in PHP, or a library we like in...
Well, now you're lying. You're lying when you say about a library you like in PHP. I know for a fact.
Yeah, I've written libraries in PHP, so I have to like them, right?
Hey, I went to your company's website, and it lists like 800 different languages you guys work with. Like, and it's got like COBOL and Fortran and shit. It does say assembler on it. But I noticed that PHP was conspicuously absent.
Let's just segue right now into PHP then.
Yes.
Yeah, whatever you're talking about wasn't important. Let's just talk about PHP.
that's right. So I used to do a lot of PHP. I used to work at Lovesac, you know, the beanbag company, right?
Beanbags.
Yeah, it's not a damn beanbag, though, because it's like shredded Durafoam, right, with changeable covers. So I used to work for Lovesac, and
exciting.
I was like a programmer for a furniture company. And, yeah. Anyway, this years and years ago, ancient history.
Right,
but no,
right.
We did a lot of PHP, and you know, I was pretty much, I knew a few languages, and I could get away with playing with the few languages, but it was early in my career, and I was doing almost everything PHP, and I really enjoyed it. And then I also was playing with XMPP PHP. So that's before it. During that time, I was handed class.jabber.php, which was the first PHP library for XMPP. This is what? This has got to be 2002, 2003. And
that's back in the heyday of PHP.
Yeah. Yeah. So I was doing that stuff, and then I just kind of migrated away from PHP. I got really into Python. Just stopped doing PHP. Well, I always felt guilty about just leaving class.jabber.php in the dust. And, you know, I saw all of these forks out there that were just kind of like, fork the whole thing, add one feature, or fix one bug and call it something else entirely.
Classic.
And so I was like, you know what? I haven't done PHP in 4 years, but I'm going to do XMPP PHP. I'm going to give you guys something, because, you know, the PHP community doesn't have anything that doesn't suck for XMPP. So I wrote XMPP PHP.
I noticed a little pause there after the doesn't have anything that doesn't suck. I noticed a little pause there.
But zing.
Well, I mean, they didn't have any really good XMPP libs.
Right.
And this one that I was supposed to maintain and abandon years ago, you know, it was just kind of, I didn't write the first one. I, you know, made a few bug fixes on it and abandoned it. I always felt guilty about that. So I wrote this XMP PHP, and I wrote it in the course of 2 evenings and just kind of let it sit there. And I was like, you know, somebody's going to pick this up and somebody will maintain it for me because I don't do any PHP, right?
Right.
But instead of maintenance requests, what I got was every day for the last 6 years, some kid from India will IM me and say, hey, I found your XMP PHP. This looks great. Can you teach me how to program? That's what it breaks down to, yeah. Right? And this the Indian programming culture is very interesting. It's very different from you know, this culture out west where programmers have some respect. Over there, programming is just something you do to make money because it's a job that's available, and there's no real culture behind it. And if you're not a man, the Peter principle is like highly accelerated over there. So if you're competent at all, you're pushed up to management. And so they really, it just makes for a bad programming culture, I guess. I just got harassed every day, twice a day for 6 years.
That's interesting.
And it wasn't even bugs. It was just like, okay, here's this. Now, how do I add an if statement to do this other thing? Right.
I've run into that here and there. I think not to the same extent that you're talking about. And won the lottery by writing something that a lot of people wanted to do something with. But I'm curious, you talked about the Indian programming culture. Is that experience that you have, is that 100% based on these like support requests you've gotten, or have you,
not 100%?
I'm actually find it kind of interesting. So I'm curious to hear you expound on that.
You know, it has nothing to do with their race or even their, you know, their culture. But their programming culture, I believe, is broken.
Interesting.
And or maybe we just have it better out here or whatever. But right. I've talked to a few. Friends of mine from India that now work out here. And that's just kind of me summarizing things that they've said. And I've probably said it terribly and I've probably offended people, but I'm kind of under the impression that that's what this show is about.
Yes, absolutely.
Oh, yes. Someone finally gets the concept. This is good.
Right. Well, so it reminds me a little bit. It's not 100% analogous, but I remember I used to work at Purdue for about 8 or 9 years. And so I had a couple student worker positions where I'd hire a student for a menial sum to do some, you know, to work for me, usually I want them to do some basic programming stuff and things like that, you know, web programming kinds of things. And, you know, I had some really good students come through, you know, who were really smart folks. And, you know, I hope they got some good experience working with me, probably not, but, they did okay. And then, you know, you get some were better than others, you know, but it generally worked out okay. But I remember one guy who was just a guy I interviewed for this position where I asked him. So he was going to be graduating it pretty soon. Like he only maybe had like a year left. And so he had been studying in, I think electrical computer engineering at Purdue, or something of that nature. And he said, his intent was he wanted to get into system administration. And I was like, oh, okay. So, well, you know, what kind of got you into that? Why were you interested in that? Thinking that the people that I run into usually end up getting into this stuff because they actually find it interesting. So he said, it seemed like not a super hard job and you got paid pretty well and you could take a lot of vacation time.
Nice. Yeah.
And that's sort of alien to me. Like, I'll freely admit that I think that as as developers, we're really damn lucky. Like, if you talk about, like, in this economy and in this stuff, that if you know what you're doing, we have
the limit, baby. Sky's the limit.
We have done extremely well. We're in an industry that has really not been impacted very much by the recent downturn in the economy. How many people that we know could talk about, like, hey, you like are excited about not having a job for a while, right? Because they could just pick and choose whatever they want, right? That is exceedingly rare, right? That just in general populace, that's really okay. But when we get to be like, oh, I'll find something else. That's fine. I'll figure it out. But I got into this, and I think most of the other people I know who are colleagues of mine, friends, got into this because they enjoy doing it. And that's why I think you're really so lucky, is because you get to do something you actually would probably do anyway, because you enjoy doing it. And it really scratches an itch that you would scratch even if you didn't get paid for it, right? So that's really awesome. And that extremely lucky, right, that we get to do that. And so if you run it, for me to run into somebody who that isn't the case at all, I'm like, why are you even fucking doing this job? Like, why would you even want to do this, then, if it's just, like, some shit that you're like, oh, I can figure it out, it seems like an easy job. I'm like, oh, it's so weird to me. But what you're describing to me kind of sounds like that, where it's like, well, it's a good job, and it's good paying, and, but you don't necessarily have a passion for it.
Right, and they don't treat it with respect. It seems like maybe the problem is that it's not being treated with respect, and this could be, old. This could be old news, and maybe the culture shifted over there.
Right.
I don't know,
yeah.
But it's it scares me. Where you're going with this, it scares me, because if Gen Y is going to be just like programmers that don't care,
yeah, right,
right. That scares me.
That guy Ed talked to is an exception.
Right? No, my impression is that this guy was just a douche. Most of the people I've run into, younger folks coming, like, they generally are interested in it, and so I don't necessarily have a concern for the future of our coding younglings, but I would be very worried if there were more people like that, because it was horrible. It was a terrible interview, but that would be a very, very different culture, and it's like that idea of having a community that really values learning and sharing, right? Like that sort of shared learning process and showing what you've done and things like that. Mm-hmm. That really values that. It's what's so cool about being a web developer, and particularly working in open source technologies. And boy, that would suck to not really feel like I had that kind of a culture.
Yeah, and there are other countries as well, particularly countries where loyalty is a huge part of their culture, mm-hmm. where you don't talk to engineers at other companies, or you don't talk to programmers at other companies, right?
Right.
And they deal with some, different cultural problems that kind of produce the same results.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's interesting you bring up cultural stuff, because I think that's a nice segue into another point here, where I was joking around with Nathan before we started recording about programmers. And so we have this whole thing that's happened. It keeps happening over and over again, where we have a bunch of I'm trying to think of the correct phrase, fucking morons who think that it is okay to be misogynist and exclusionary. And I don't know quite what to make of it, because it keeps happening over and over again. And I think the sad truth is that a lot of people it's a cultural thing, just as much as the stuff you talked about before, the things that you've seen and have been told about programming culture in India. there's the rise of the programmer. I think the programmer is a result of programming being considered interesting, challenging, and well rewarding on the monetary side of things. So anytime there's lots of money kicking around, the douchebags always show up. So we have now the ugly programmer stereotype. You know, the guy who had the guys with the pop collars and the rocking the faux hawk and the big aviator shades and the brags about how they do code in between push-ups and how after work they're going to go dead squat 400 pounds at the gym.
Well, at least these guys are obvious. I think maybe there's some subtler things going on that's not so obvious. Like these programmers, at least they're labeling themselves out in the open and we can easily identify what they're about. You know, maybe the problem's more subtle than that underneath.
Yeah, I don't know. See, one thing is that I haven't actually run into a lot of people like that in real life. Like these stereotypical, you know, programmer types. That was kind of news to me because I haven't run into a lot of people like that.
Seems more like a Bay Area type thing.
Maybe
I don't know. I've spent a lot of time in the Bay Area, and I haven't seen it very much.
Like I've seen a lot
just
of
an isolated incident sort of thing. Maybe it's just
I've seen a lot of dudes with plaid button down shirts and thick rimmed glasses and messy hair. I see a lot of those dudes. Sure. That stereotype actually plays out pretty well.
So where are all the programmers?
I think it's made up, to be honest. I think it was an article, and it was that. I mean, look, I'm sure you have pockets of it. Like, who were those D-bags who were in Boston who did that thing where
die hackathon thing, yeah.
Yeah.
Where they advertised, hey, dudes, we're going to have women handing out beer. So
right. Right, yeah. And what was worse is actually if you went back like through their posterous stuff, like when they posted blogs about things and shit like that, they were way 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 worse. Like they were posting pictures of topless women in, you know, on their, you know, blog posts and shit like this. Like it was just really tacky, right? And it was just like there was no sense of like understanding that of what they were doing. It was just like, you know, so it wasn't
even a marketing thing.
Huh? Yeah, no, they're just fucking idiots. Like, and you know, so there's definitely more of that douchiness. And you see that kind of vibe more, I think, amongst, VCs and investor culture. I think I see more of that with like the guys who are like, you know, trying to get into, you know, accelerators and like how, you know, constantly asking questions about basically how do I pitch right so that I can trick this guy into giving me money, you know, shit like that. Yeah, I definitely feel like I've seen more of it in that kind of culture, but I don't know. That's a money thing, you know. That's a money culture. That's a financial thing. So it's sort of not surprising you see more dickheads in that. It seems like, but. I haven't seen it, you know. I haven't seen like this stuff as much in. I don't know. I think the programmer is kind of it. I don't think it's an actual trend. I think that I have, at least in my anecdotal evidence, I don't have much of it. You know.
I haven't seen it in person. So I suspect it's isolated incidents, but it. Maybe we should keep our eye out open for something more subtle than that. I don't know.
So, Ed, this is the point of our podcast where we also have to say something nice about the sponsor again. So do we have something to make fun of Engine Yard this week, or are we going to be straight up about it?
Let me see if they have anything new on their website. So, as you know, we are sponsored by Engine Yard, which we totally forgot to say at the beginning of this podcast. So,
no, I said it.
Did you? I wasn't listening.
Yeah, he did it.
Okay, I was not even.
Gotta keep the sponsors happy.
Let's see here. Did you know that Toyota Kenya is a customer of Engine Yard?
I did not know that.
Well, now you do. Let's see, who else? MTV. Very exciting. Badgeville. I've never heard of that. Bayer Advanced. The aspirin company. Let's see here.
Bayer, that little pill that girls are supposed to keep between their knees so they don't get pregnant. That company.
That is the other thing that they do. Yes.
Right.
Hey, look at this. There's a new blog post that Engine Yard joins the Apache CloudStack project.
Yeah, that's something I saw. So we have OpenStack, which is supposed to be like a way to like run your own sort of EC2 type setup.
Right.
And now it appears that the CloudStack thing is doing an end around around everything that OpenStack's been working on.
I got to tell you something. The advantage of cloud services to me are that I don't have to run them.
Sure.
So I'm not sure why I want to make my own, but please continue.
I guess some people get hung up on ownership of servers and ownership of data and stuff. So I could see.
Yeah, no, actually, I can see that.
Especially if you've like bought a whole bunch of like really high end servers. And now they're saying, we should move to the cloud so we can take advantage of blah, blah, blah. And then some dude's like, we have all these servers that we just bought, sir. So someone says, you know what? It'd be fucking awesome if you could run our own private stuff on our own hardware.
I think there's a lot of areas where that makes sense, especially if you have say a large organization that has to have an internal that has enough of a justification for having basically an internal platform to build on like that. A real good example is that they basically do stuff like that at Purdue, right? So a large, state university focused on research, and they'll have like a campus-wide IT team, and then you've got a bunch of different schools and departments under those schools, and each one of them can act as a customer. On their own to independently say, yeah, I want to take advantage of this service, right? So, and because it doesn't necessarily make sense that they can, that it's a lot more complicated for them to just go in and say, I'm just going to pay Amazon to do it. Because then there's stuff like, I'm a nonprofit, so are you going to charge me tax? And are you going to, there's bunches of stuff that goes into and, what's okay to put on that kind of a system and what's not okay to put on that kind of a system. If you're dealing with education, you've got FERPA regulations, junk like that. So there's a bunch of stuff like that. So with these larger organizations, it actually, I think, does make a lot of sense to be able to build those kinds of platforms in-house.
Sure. So Engine Yard, again, they're more like a platform as a service type thing. So a kind of a step up from doing all your shit yourself on Amazon. So, Engine Yard's thing is all about you have an idea, you need to get it up quickly. They provide you with what I call containers, so a whole bunch of containers that you can run your apps in. And Engine Yard also is the home of our awesome friends from Orchestra.io, and they're awesome, nicely scalable PHP solution. So if you're thinking about doing your stuff as if you have an app, you have an idea, and you think of going the platform as a service route, definitely check out Engine Yard. They were one of the trailblazers for a platform as a service.
And they will proudly accept Indian programmers, unlike
anything Nathan does.
Anything Nathan is doing, yeah.
Yeah, I immediately regretted saying that.
I'm sorry. It's I don't mean to tease you about that.
No regrets. Always look forward. Nathan never looked.
You know what? I originally didn't think it had anything to do with the Indian programming culture. I thought it was a PHP cultural problem.
Right. Well, it probably is.
And so I was talking to a friend of mine that grew up in India, and he was saying, "Oh no, I think it's more of a business cultural and programming cultural problem."
That's interesting. So what you're saying is, because you have an Indian friend, it's okay for you to,
right. Black people love me,
right? Yes, of course. Yeah. And white people, you have white friends.
I have gay friends. Yeah,
right. So it's cool.
I can't use
CoffeeScript.
No, it's just, I'm just relaying something else that somebody said. But
the short of it, getting off of your racial overtones, is that, so you put a couple days work in and you got like a shit ton of support requests for it and basically no, like, hey, I'll help you out with maintaining this, it sounds like.
Right. And now I just point people to a different XMPP PHP solution.
Well, I guess that's one way to do it.
That's right. Go bug this guy over here. It's like when, you know, the kid asks you, I want to do something. What did your mom say? Go ask your mom. So there you go. All right. So now we get to the meat of the podcast here. The thing that I really was interested in finding out is that we're going to move on and talk about the real-time web. So I wrote down a couple of things here. So the first thing I think would be fair, since Nathan is the appointed by me expert on real-time web. So we're going to look at this and say, so if you had to describe what the real-time web is to somebody, and from a technical side too, because it's only highly technical people who bother listening to this podcast anyway. So why don't you explain to us what the real-time web is?
Well, what people assume it is that the page changes live, and that's part of it. You know, in getting a little bit more technical, it's that you don't have to pull for data that is pushed. Well, it's not always the case, but you know, that's generally what real-time web is. To get really specific and accurate about what real-time web is taking data from disparate sources, from many sources, from, you know, in the social web, it's from lots of users, and from, you know, in a dashboard application, it might be from lots of servers telling you their status or whatever. Real-time web is taking data from lots of places and curating it and putting it in front of a user.
That's pretty basic.
Yeah.
So what are some, clearly you do a lot of work yourself with real-time stuff. What are some of the common stacks of technology that you see, that you find people using when they're building real-time web apps?
Well, since you generally want to push the data to the client, what you tend to see is less Apache-based stacks, less running the web server separately. So generally what you see is the HTTP server is actually part of the application itself. And you started to see that with big in the Ruby community, and even before that, the Perl community, where your application runs as an HTTP server. You run a bunch of copies. You put it behind Apache or behind Nginx or even behind HAProxy, right? And that's a major difference that you see from the traditional LAMP stack, is that the application needs to be the HTTP server, or else it makes things a lot easier for the application to be the HTTP server.
I explained some of this to Ed when we were talking about this last time when we recorded this when I was in La Crosse, about the idea that sort of a more modern stack these days is you'll have a web server and the web server's job is to serve up static content and then proxy requests over to some sort of application server. So in many ways, it sounds like you're saying that for real-time apps, the app itself becomes the application server.
Yeah, and that's almost a requirement for push data. If you look at, for example, WebSockets implementations for PHP, you run it from PHP CLI, and it's its own HTTP service.
That sounds really painful, trying to do WebSockets in PHP.
Well, that's what I wonder. So I the last couple of days I've kind of done a little bit of research on it, and it looks like a few people have done it, and it's a bit painful. And I haven't seen a whole lot of, you know, big activity over there for it. Now you also have PHP bindings for something like libevent, right?
Right.
Maybe that would make things less painful. So instead of you linked me right before the podcast to 5.4, and it's got an embedded HTTP server, but it very specifically says this is not for production. You just use it for testing.
For now, it's not for production, but I think that you could look at that as the tip of the wedge. I don't know the exact, I'm failing to find a proper analogy, but that could be the foot, you know, get the foot in the door and start thinking about making that sort of PHP as an app server idea work a little bit better.
Right. And, you know, I think a lot of developers, I know I did, I gagged at the idea of, you know, your HTTP server being part of your application. You know, it's kind of a scary idea, but that's been the model now, and it works well. So what makes Node special for real-time web beyond that is that the whole language is in an event loop, right? So everything's asynchronous by default. And because of that, you're able to deal with events as they come in, which is why, you know, to go back to Redis now, if something changes in the Redis database, you don't need this cluster environment of and rumoring between your processes. It's just the database reports that a user has done something because you've got publish subscribe channels on it. That can bubble up into the Node process and pop right into the event loop and be handled. The same is true with the HTTP connections coming in. Those just pop into the event loop and are handled. The PHP community is, or not the community, but the language itself is evolving that direction with both embedded HTTP service and lib event bindings.
So would you say that it's pretty much impossible to build a real-time web application without it being asynchronous at the heart of it? Because it seems to me that would be kind of... That you are really reacting to events. So if you don't have an event-driven system at the core of it, that you're going to have a really hard time making stuff work.
It's going to be more of a pain. I wouldn't say it's impossible, but you're going to be doing a lot more polling. You're going to be doing, you know, various tricks. You're going to be working around the fact that you're not event-driven. But that's not to say it's impossible. It's just going to be less convenient in the least.
So we have Node as probably the main, the best known one of these sort of asynchronous type things. I know from the Python world, from my dalliances into Python, that we've got Twisted, yep. And we've got Tornado.
Mm-hmm.
And on the Ruby side, I think we've got Event Machine, and yep. Is it Goliath is another one that. I remember on another podcast, on the Changelog podcast, they spoke to the guy who was kind of the driving force behind Goliath. So, like, what are some other, because we're talking about Stacks, so what are some of the other tools that you see people using? So clearly they're using some sort of tool that will act as their application server, usually speaking over HTTP. It's usually event-driven. So what are some of the other pieces that you're seeing being commonly used?
Well, you've also message queues like ZeroMQ or even bigger AMQP servers, and basically some sort of message channel routing. As I said, Redis has publish subscribe channels, and that's almost always a component in it, something that will do message queuing and routing.
So, Ed, what do you know about ZeroMQ?
Nothing.
So maybe I've read a little bit about ZeroMQ, and the thing that's always kind of made me wonder about ZeroMQ is I need somebody who's used it to explain to me a kind of a real-world practical way that you would use ZeroMQ. So you think you can, like, give us a quick little, maybe like 5-minute overview of ZeroMQ and how it would fit in and how it's being used?
I've only played with it and seen how other people can use it, but I can give you some examples for what kinds of things, what things that kind of thing is useful for.
Right.
And it boils down to inter-process communication and channels of interest. So if you're going to scale, you're either going to shard or you're going to... you're going to have some sort of HA system, right, where you have multiple processes talking to each other. ZeroMQ and other channel bindings are also useful for if you have things written in different languages and running on separate platforms. So say you have, you want to do reporting out of QuickBooks or something, and that's got to run on a Windows machine. Well, you can start popping, you know, things into ZeroMQ as they come in, and you can have a worker popping them out, you know, in the language of your choice, say, you know, PHP on a Nix server somewhere, right? And actually processing these invoices that are coming in. So inter-process communication, job systems, and anything that involves multiple languages or multiple platforms.
Yeah, that doesn't help me much, but I think I'll eventually get it.
Well, like what I'm doing with Thunk is I'm turning the problem on its head a little bit, where when you change the data in the database, no matter where you change it from, no matter what language, what process, whatever, the event bubbles out that says you created this thing or you edited this thing or whatever you did. Your action goes to the processes that are subscribed to that action.
Now that makes sense. So it seems that much, I understand.
So what things like message queues do is instead of taking that approach, when one process wants to say something to another process, it goes into a message queue and pops out. It's just like either you're doing multicast, which is where you're trying to broadcast out that this thing has happened, right? So people might use, say, if they didn't have something like Thunk or Redis, they might say, okay, well, whenever I do this SQL entry, I'm also going to pop into ZeroMQ that I made a new user. And then all of the processes running your service are aware that there's this new user.
Gotcha. I think I'm starting to understand this.
Sounds like magic. Black magic.
Well, in a lot of ways it is magic, but it's,
sure.
But if you have a wand and you can direct the traffic to where you want to go, it's not so bad.
Yeah, there you go.
Well, and it's all about, you know, if I just want to write a million different processes instead of a really tall stack, I can write a really wide stack with something like this. Like in And Bang, we could, there was the April Fool's joke here in the office. Okay. Was that we're all on this dev version of And Bang and we're in the chat room. Right. And on April 2nd, actually, cause April 1st was a Sunday, people started coming into the office and everyone in the chat room is saying like random ridiculous quotes. Right. And one of our devs had done is he put like this Arduino in the refrigerator. Okay. And anytime someone opened the fridge, it would, have somebody random in the chat room say some random quote from a quote website. And so that's interesting because this Arduino can you know, interact with all these other processes because everything's, you know, database-based. You change the data in the database, well, it bubbles up, right? The other direction would be, say for whatever reason we wanted to change the word Christmas to Xmas everywhere, we could intercept anytime we see the word Christmas in a task or in a chat or whatever, we could edit that and republish it back in as Xmas. And it wouldn't have to be written in the same language and it would bubble up to all the processes and everybody would see it live. So we can just, if we want to add functionality, we don't actually have to edit our code. We can just add processes.
All right. So getting back to the real-time web stack. So we have some sort of event-driven application server. We have message queues that allow processes to send information back and forth to provide updates and things like that. So again, is that really just at its most basic, those are kind of the components you need for a real-time app?
Yeah. Yeah. You know, you're better off if you have a stack that has an event loop and you probably want some way of managing messages And then on the client side, which we haven't talked about yet, you want a way of receiving those messages from maybe disparate sources or from several sources and dealing with them within the client.
So and for real time, go ahead.
That's where you see the popularity of things like Backbone, Backbone.js. I'm sure you guys have heard murmurs of this.
Oh yeah.
And because basically the idea is that you have then one of our notes here on the Pirate Pad is like the death of MVC, right? And that's ridiculous. We all know that's ridiculous. But what we see is that MVC has moved. Because we're doing custom databases and messages that bubble out from all these different places and get to the client based on the client's interest and access, the MVC model moves up to the client. Because in real time, it's all about information from many places. And so we don't actually have a model on the server. Or at least we don't have a model at the lowest levels of the server because the data is coming in from different places. And so the model moves up to the client because the client's gathering all this info. It may get data from the user typing in something. It may get data from a WebSocket connection. It could get data from polling some other thing. And it brings in this data and it puts it in something like Backbone. And now you have MVC.
And in fact, I think the MVC model that you have there is closer to the real MVC that was described like in the original paper, because you've got the model actually updating UI and stuff like that. You know, the views are smarter and things like that. Whereas I think the traditional model that you saw of MVC on in a server-side application that was generating HTML was that the views were very, very dumb. Right. And you didn't have direct interaction between view and model, and vice versa.
Right. If all your data is in the DOM, it becomes really hard to manage multiple sources of data.
Right.
So keeping this data in a model layer is a lot more manageable.
Yeah.
So these days, I mean, really, is JavaScript your only choice for the client side part of real time web apps? Because it seems to me that it's JavaScript or, I don't know, you're pounding your head on a desk somewhere to figure out how to make it work without relying on JavaScript.
All right. JavaScript's the only language that all browsers support embedded in, you know, for client side execution. So,
yeah. And you need that logic to do it. I mean, it goes back to being a pretty dumb client. It's just a real simple static presentation layer. I mean, there's tiny little UI things you can do in CSS and stuff, but it's
sure.
The logic is very minimal. So, yeah, that's what made it possible to do, to put the to implement the UI logic actually in the UI, program, was that you had to have that stuff in there. And JavaScript's the only thing that's universally available. I mean, you see little things like, I don't know what, Dart. Is that a thing? And
it's trying to be a thing.
Right. And, you know, I don't know if IE still supports VBScript like in newer versions or not, but that, you know, that's really the only option you have for that. I mean, I guess the other way you look at it is that, well, if you're talking about desktop browsers, really, when you're talking about that, because it's not, you know, there's certainly a whole model when you go to other devices that you have front ends written in other languages. I mean, you know, is it Objective-C app on iOS or a Java app in Android, sure, or things like that? So it's just another way of presenting that kind of thing.
Yeah, and those aren't browsers, right?
Exactly. So I'm just saying, it's like, you know, there's that. Yeah, Right. I mean, yeah, if you're talking about browsers, JavaScript's the only option, the only realistic option you have.
I can sense Ed getting a little punchy, so I think we're almost at our almost out of time here.
Dad,
so,
I'm tired.
So the other thing that I thought was interesting that I put into the Pirate Pad, whereas I wanted to get some thoughts on, you know, what you think is probably the biggest misconception about real-time apps. And I think it's more in terms of how you have to put one, how you approach putting one together. Like, do you see any sort of anti-patterns or assumptions that people are making when they're discussing the architecture and implementation of real-time apps?
I don't know. Maybe my head's just too far down, but like, I don't really see too much of that. What I do see is that people go ACK callbacks or ACK deferreds or, you know, whatever the whatever your event loop uses to deal with events coming in. It's really a different way of thinking, and people fight it. And it's really easy. It's really easy to discount it as necessary. But those kinds of patterns, deferreds, callbacks, and I think there's one more. I don't even remember what it's called. But promises is just another way of doing callbacks. But those kinds of things are actually necessary in an event loop, and it looks like unnecessary nonsense when you first get into it, and you just have to sort of trust that it isn't and really take the time to understand it.
Yeah, you just got to power through that shit. I mean, I know from my own experiences, of course, having so many years of sequential programming is the only other way to really describe it, that trying to wrap the mind around events, callbacks, deferreds, yields, promises, whatever you want to call them. It is very difficult because I find my own experiences, and even with the stuff that you've helped me with, Nathan, is looking at it and saying, you know what, it's not as obvious to someone when they look at the code what the flow of information through it's going to be. Because, I mean, when you talk about writing PHP code, server-side dynamic scripting stuff, unless you've really fucked it up, it actually is pretty easy to kind of trace through what happens when you make a request and where all that stuff goes. And you can probably, you probably only have to go a few layers deep, again, unless you really mess things up. And I found that when I'm looking at the Node.js code that I've written, and I look at it and I find, this is probably a good analogy, that stuff is slowly bubbling up from the code through the keyboard to my fingers into my brain. It's going the other way. Instead of me getting ideas and stuff out of my brain through my fingers onto the keyboard and into code, it's coming back up the other way as I start to understand, I understand now that I can just, all I have to do is pass that callback from place to place where it's going to go. And then the whole sort of event thing takes care of triggering the callback at the appropriate time. So, you know, Ed and I joke about black magic and code and stuff, but to a lot of programmers who are just like me with similar levels of experience of only kind of with sequential and doing basically not doing request driven request loops for things and not event loops, is that this is, it looks a lot like black magic, and you're putting a lot of trust into a programming paradigm that that a lot of people probably aren't comfortable with.
Yeah, and you know, it's taken me a year to get to where I am, and I still you know have to get myself into that thinking, and I think, okay, you know, I've got this callback, and I'm going to pass it to each thing that may or may not break execution path and come back later. And it's an entirely different way of thinking, and it just takes time.
So what are some good resources you think people should take a look at if they're interested in learning more about building real-time apps?
My book, which is coming out.
I'm looking forward to seeing that.
I've been
book was relevant to your interests, so I could swap copies with you.
I don't know. I'm not the resources sort. I just like to get my hands dirty. But you for a JavaScript programmer specifically, the Mozilla MDN, what is it called? Mozilla Developer Network, is the best resource for JavaScript, client side or server side. It is just good. You know, you guys in the PHP world are very spoiled in terms of documentation.
Yeah.
but MDN is great. And for, I don't know, it's just kind of this new wave thing. I'm sure there's Ruby resources for like Event Machine, but I couldn't tell you any specifics.
So maybe what you're saying is that probably the best way to approach this is understanding that there are some sort of basic blocks that you need to basic blocks that you're going to have to put together to build a real-time app. And that you should investigate them. So that means finding something that can act as your application server that's event-driven, start looking at message queues, and then start looking at JavaScript client-side frameworks and techniques.
Definitely look at Backbone and Spine and the related, you know, those sorts of solutions.
Awesome. So, Ed, anything else you want to talk about?
No, I think I'm all vented out, bro.
Events are good, bro.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
So anyway, Nathan, thanks so much for coming on. You are one smart motherfucker, and I have learned a ton tonight about real-time stuff. And just for me, it's been more like with my usual kind of way of finding about technology is kind of looking at stuff and digging a little bit deep and then maybe coming back out and looking at something else. And so I kind of do mental maps of things in weird ways. And so this has been very good for me to understand if I'm interested in understanding how to build a real-time web app, about learning a bit about the fundamentals and about what components go into one. So this has been incredibly informative for me.
Great. Well, I apologize for my racist slurs,
dude, we have said many, many worse things than that.
Man. Far, far worse,
far worse. So I think we're at the point where we got to wrap it up. Once again, let's thank our sponsor, Engine Yard, and their awesome platform as a service offerings. And another shout out to our folks from Orchestra.io who are flying the freak flag proudly for PHP platform as a service. So this has been episode 9 of the Development Hell podcast. You can find me online via Twitter as Grumpy Programmer without the U. You can find Ed as Funkatron with the U. You can find the podcast itself as dev_hell on Twitter. And also do not forget to visit the website devhell.info. So thanks as always, and we will talk to all of you next week.
Okay.